This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to be talking about the disappearance of a United States Air Force general. General William Neil McCasland disappeared on February the 27th. This is very relevant to our whole field, the whole UFO field. We're going to be talking to Micah Hanks, the editor of The Debrief, arguably the leading newsletter and news resource in the field. You can find him at MicahHanks.com, and you can subscribe to The Debrief, which I would heartily recommend you doing. I read it every single week. I would like to begin by reading the latest report. This is from Friday, the 13th of March, 2026, from the Bernardino County Sheriff's Office. This is a report released this morning where the investigation is at the present time. Then we're going to go into a deep discussion with Micah about just how this intersects with the whole issue of UFOs, UAPs, and all of the things that concern each one of us so much. The Bernardino County Sheriff's Office continues the missing person investigation into the disappearance of 68-year-old William Neil McCasland, the last known to have been at or near his residence in the area of Quail Run Court, N.E., on the morning of Friday, February the 27th, 2026. A silver alert remains in effect, and Mr. McCasland remains missing. A silver alert does not mean that he has Alzheimer's or anything. It relates only to his age as being above the age of 65. And General McCasland is in good health mentally and physically, as far as everyone knows. As previously stated, General McCasland is a retired U.S. Air Force general. BCSO is the lead investigative agency and continues to coordinate with partner agencies in support of investigative follow-up and search operations, including the FBI Albuquerque Field Office, when tools, tactics, or techniques can assist. Search resources are coordinated through the New Mexico Department of Public Safety and New Mexico State Police Search and Rescue System, with volunteer search teams assisting. BCSO is releasing the following verified timeline to provide clarity on what is known. On February the 27th, at approximately 10 a.m., a repairman was at the residence and interacted with Mr. McCasland. At approximately 11:10 a.m., Ms. McCasland Wilkerson left the home for a medical appointment. At approximately 12:04 p.m., she returned home, and General McCasland was not there. His phone, prescription glasses, and wearable devices were located in the residence. Mrs. McCasland Wilkerson began attempting to locate Mr. McCasland and contacted family and friends. At approximately 3:07 p.m., she reported him missing, and the investigation began immediately. As the investigation has progressed, BCSO has identified items believed to be unaccounted for from the residence. Investigators believe Mr. McCasland may have been wearing a shirt shown in a photo, which we will have on our website. The photo depicts Mr. McCasland wearing a light green long sleeve button-up outdoor shirt. Addition items believed to be missing, and listen carefully, folks, include his hiking boots, wallet, and a .38 caliber revolver with a leather holster. Investigators have located a gray U.S. Air Force sweatshirt approximately a mile and a half east of the residence on Saturday, March the 7th. The item was collected and processed. No blood was detected during initial processing, and an additional analysis is pending. The sweatshirt has not been confirmed by family or friends to be associated with Mr. McCasland. However, it prompted an additional target search in the area. BCSO continues to pursue all credible leads and follow-ups on every tip received. While there is currently no evidence indicating foul play, investigators are examining all available information as the case remains active. Investigators have expanded the neighborhood canvas to more than 700 homes, requesting security video and information. Additional search efforts have included drone operations, helicopter support, ground searches with search and rescue teams, canine searches. To date, BCSO has not received any confirmed sighting or information video showing Mr. McCaslin leaving the area or indicating a direction of travel. Such efforts and investigative follow-up are ongoing. There we have it. That's where we are. He seems to have simply vanished into thin air with a loaded 38 revolver in his pocket and his wallet. Welcome to Dreamland, Micah. Let's get on with this terrifying and bizarre story. I would like to begin by asking you this. What is the most, let's look at his career first. Can you give us an idea of exactly what his career was?
Certainly. I think that's another great addition. And by the way, thank you for introducing the discussion with what we know directly from the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department, because as you know, and I want to really emphasize to your listeners, it is crucial at this stage to go off of what information authorities have been able to provide. That's the confirmed timeline as of, I believe, late yesterday that you just shared with us. So again, thank you for doing that. Whitley, to your question, by the way, what we currently know, and I'll offer a brief summary, which we featured in the newsletter this week at the debrief, after his graduation at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology, he served at the Secretary of the Air Force's Office of Special Projects out of its Los Angeles division. He worked early on there on highly classified satellite programs, this with the National Reconnaissance Office and certain others. Then he went on after this in the 1990s and 2000s. To Buckley Air Force Base. And again, this information is all directly available for any who are interested in reading this on his official biography page at the U.S. Air Force website. He directed mission planning for the Aerospace Data Facility there. He later commanded its operations squadron. After that, he served as a chief engineer of the Navstar GPS Joint Program Office there again, also at Los Angeles Air Force Base. Specifically, that was the Space-Based Laser Program Office, as I understand it, and then also directed the Vehicles Directorate at the Air Force Research Laboratory at Kirtland Air Force Base. There were many other things that he did over the years as well, but two of the most important, and that I think will be especially relevant to what we're discussing, Whitley, are McCaslin's work there as the Executive Secretary of the Special Access Program Oversight Committee. Essentially, he played an integral role in oversight of the management of special access programs in the United States. This is directly relevant, of course, to our mutual area of interest. But then his final assignment there, I believe, beginning in 2011, brought him to the Air Force Research Laboratory at none other than the historic Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, former home of the semi-legendary Project Blue Book, which remains the longest systematic U.S. investigation into, people who have followed this for a while, like you and I, we've called them UFOs for some time. Military parlance these days is unidentified anomalous phenomena, or UAP, but those government investigations officially began right there at Wright-Patt, and that's where he served. And then there's so much more we can get into, but as far as his official background, I think that really conveys to your listeners the importance of the work that he did and why he is right now not only a missing person and we're concerned for his safety, but he's someone who's captured the attention of many.
Well, the reason it has captured my attention is the extraordinary knowledge that he must possess. When did he retire, Micah?
That's a good question. I believe that he continued working there until 2013, and I believe he retired that year. Now, also, of course, as you and I know, and listeners out there may also be aware of, almost immediately following his retirement, within maybe 3 years there, he also began doing consultation work to Blink-182 rocker Tom DeLonge, who, of course, is also well known in the modern kind of renaissance we've seen with this topic. So even after his retirement in 2013, McCaslin obviously was still offering his expertise, and he was also involved in other organizations as a civilian. So you might say his work actually continued beyond his official U.S. Air Force work that ended in 2013.
We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Micah Hanks.
Listen to this excerpt from Transformation 2026 about an abduction that happened to someone working with me last summer.
In May of this year, the woman who was working on the creative project with me woke up to find herself being watched by a gray who looked like the being on the cover of Communion. When my co-worker thought to herself that she was terribly frightened and wished that it was dawn, a gigantic light immediately flooded the room. As her fear inexplicably melted away, she was grabbed by the wrist and lifted toward the ceiling. She remembers moving up right through the ceiling. Her next memory is of finding herself in a heap on the floor of the bedroom, and the light of the dawn was just coming in the windows.
Transformation 2026. The deepest dive into the close encounter experience that has ever been published. Get it now in audio, as a Kindle, as a hardcover, as a paperback, available on Audible and on Amazon and on Apple Audiobooks.
UAPs, aliens, magic, breakthrough tech, psi phenomenon, esoterica, psychedelics, cryptids, time slips, poltergeists, and sundry. The days of dismissing these complicated human experiences as mere delusions, hoaxes, fantasies, and dreams needs to be over. Instead, we need to explore and understand these events for what they might be telling us about the nature of the universe and of ourselves. The ancients taught that we're each an energetic expression of the living cosmos, but we still don't know what that means. What is real? What is fantasy? How do each of our lives and experiences fit within the broader tapestry of being? Are we alone? Where does narrative fit? And what happens when we die? Join me on Neon Galactic, a podcast produced by yours truly to push the boundaries of old paradigms in science, philosophy, ontology, anthropology, and more. This show is an experiment in radical hermeneutics, breaking down old walls to embrace the strange and existentially transformative, to get beyond old prejudices and realize at last that we are indeed more complicated and connected as a species than many of us ever dreamed. Find me on Patreon, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts to take a journey to unknown places on a quest to the limits of this reality and beyond. At such a fraught and dangerous moment in human history, the time has definitely come to reassess the wisdom of our ancestors and embrace the natural truths we've long rejected. Join our intrepid crew in throwing open the gates of perception to welcome wonder back into the workaday world.
We're talking to Micah Hanks, the editor of The Debrief. Go to MicahHanks.com. Sign up for The Debrief if you want to know what's actually going on in the world of UFOs, UAP, and everything associated with it. One of the things that happened in his career was after he was at the Secretary of the Air Force's Special Projects Office, he went to MIT for a period of time. And he began to continued work after getting his doctorate, which is no small feat at from MIT. It's a big deal to get a doctorate there. And so this was a brilliant man. There's no question about that. He was really a top level performer at every respect. So he. Then went to Buckley Air Force Base, where he directed mission planning for the Air Force Data Facility and commanded its operations squadron. Now, this is not really, I would be surprised if he had been read in on any UAP-related things at that point. But then the move to the Navistar GPS Joint Program at Los Angeles, AFB, then the space-based laser program, and it was laser physics that he studied at MIT, then he begins to get into our space. And the reason is that we have been building and working on for years. I mean, really a long time, some kind of beam-related weapons that could affect UAP, and have had some success at that, actually, as I understand it. I mean, I'm not read in on anything, so I have no idea. But what do you think? Can you expand a little bit on this point in the general's career?
Certainly, Whitley. You know, in general terms, with his background working with navigational satellites, laser systems, space technologies, also his association not only at Los Angeles Air Force Base, but they're also at Kirtland. Kirtland, again, being semi-legendary in terms of, you know, facilities in the United States with their association to UAP. And something else significant, too, I think, in addition to the study of the phenomenon, which, again, really, I think for people like you and I, Whitley, it's always been what's driven our interest. We're fascinated with the phenomenon. When we have to put on our reporter hats on days like today and say, what are the facts and what do we know? It's also important to look at the disinformation aspect of this. You've written about it. Kirtland Air Force Base plays an integral role with that. Now, I'm not insinuating in any way that McCaslin was involved with that, but it is important in the history of this topic, and he certainly worked there. And one of the reasons for the disinformation associated with Kirtland has to do with some of those laser technologies and capabilities that were being developed there, and the interpretation that UFOs either were involved in some way or mistaken for U.S. government systems. So you might argue that there's a very intricate relationship between the locations where he worked and the technologies that he worked on, that Major McCaslin specialized in, and UFO history. And that's something that goes back at least to the 2000s and even before that, the 1990s. Coming up into the new millennium, again, I find it very hard to imagine that if a person who had, by 2016, as we know, and the story behind this maybe we should get into as well, how we know about his association with Tom DeLonge, because that too is interesting. But if Major General McCaslin had been providing his official perspectives as a consultant to Tom DeLonge on the UAP issue, I find it very hard to believe that his past work not only provided some unique insights into this, but also that he didn't have personally some information or interest in that topic.
The president has directed the Defense Department to release all of its documents involving UFOs and aliens. There are rumors that this might actually happen, and even that they might tell the truth. If you read the Whitley Strieber Substack or my most recent blog on unknowncountry.com, I explain exactly why. But if it does happen, does it also mean direct contact with aliens for more people? What happens if they come into your life, your children's lives? It's not going to be abductions like it was in the past. It's going to be a very different experience, something much more like what happened to my family after the communion experience. I wrote two books about it, Transformation and Breakthrough. They were beaten to death by the media and not much read, but they remain the only chronicle of such an experience that has ever been put into print. They're a blueprint for how to make contact work, and it can work. And that is certainly very important. Governments come and governments go, but the visitors are going to be in our lives from now on, forever. So how do we handle this? Is it good? Bad? Are we in danger? Or at the start of something wonderful? Find out how one family made contact work in Transformation 2026, the massive update to the original book, available now on Amazon.com. Let's talk a little bit about the effort that Tom DeLonge began to make. He started, I think, in 2016, really. I was not too interested in it until Hal Puthoff mentioned him to me. And I tried to interview him. He wouldn't talk to me at all, which immediately made me very suspicious, because I always think that there are people who won't talk to me, and a lot of them have a Defense Department locomotion, because there are elements of the DOD who have said they don't want their people talking in the close encounter space at all. So I thought, well, exactly who is this guy? I mean, he's a rock and roller, and he seemed to come out of nowhere. Do you know anything about his motives for appearing in the UFO space all of a sudden?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Whitley. I do know this. Now, some fun facts. In addition to his work with music, he also had relaunched the To the Stars effort and had, you know, kind of dabbled in weird news because he always loved the UFO report. I think, in fact, I'm sorry, UFO subject. He had even written a song talking about, you know, how aliens are real. So this is no secret to longtime fans of his music, one of whom had been my younger brother, who for a short period, due to some associations that he had with other journalists who were covering the UAP topic, on invitation from those writers, my brother Caleb actually for a short time was an artist for that To the Stars relaunch that Tom did prior to the one that most people know about. That ran for only a very short time. They were covering space and UAP-related stories. Everyone was essentially told at one point, you know, we're going to kind of go in a different direction. Thank you, everyone, for your work. After a few months passed, Tom resurfaces, and this at this point it was probably 2017, with the To the Stars Academy for Arts and Sciences. And now it's no longer a media site covering these kinds of topics. Now they're essentially kind of a think tank, I guess might be one way that you could describe this. And with their launch in October of 2017, we saw for the first time essentially the grouping together all in one place of former officials that include Christopher Mellon, Luis Elizondo, and several others. Hal Putoff, who you mentioned there and whom you've known for quite a while.
Jim Simivan.
Yeah, Jim Simivan, indeed. So Steve Justice as well. So there were many people who were working with Tom at that time, which I think, Whitley, it is fair to say took a lot of people off off guard. They didn't expect something along these lines. But that certainly was also the case later that year when in 2017, in December, I believe, we also learned for the first time of the program at that time being referred to as ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. So some of those very officials who appeared on that stage in October of that year with Tom DeLonge had been involved with that effort. And since that time, we've learned much more about this. But that's really Tom's involvement and how he came to first be known about this unique relationship, you might say, he had with former defense officials.
Yes, and he, you know, when I was much younger, he's getting much younger, much, much younger every day, I knew General Arthur Exon quite well and fairly well. And he told me that after he and my uncle, Edward Streber, who both worked on this, the Roswell materials directly at Wright Field back in the late 40s and early 50s, he told me that as late as 1988, he was still consulting with the committee at Wright that was studying this subject. And the reason he was doing that was because it had been so secret in his day that there was a lot that they had done that wasn't recorded at all. It was all, the meetings were all pencils up. And I'm wondering, it seems to me that that General McCaslin's relationship to this topic kind of intersects because General Exon was also commanding general at Wright Pat at one point, and it's had a seemingly kind of peripheral relationship to this stuff. But now I can't get away from knowledge of lasers and also my knowledge that laser technology is certainly important in trying to for us to establish some kind of control over the movement of UAP in our airspace, which, you know, I'm not going to go into my own opinion about that, but it would seem to me that he was in an incredibly knowledgeable and highly sensitive position. So let's now talk about a little bit about the leaked emails of John Podesta, the leak that occurred in 2016, that reveals a little bit about what DeLonge knew about General McCaslin. By the way, is there any exchange at all of those emails just from Tom, and there's no replies from John? Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Whitley. The one that is available, and anyone, by the way, who wants to read this can find this online if you just go and do a search for General William McCaslin, or you might search for Neil McCaslin WikiLeaks, because on the WikiLeaks website, that single email with McCaslin's name at the top appears. And in it, as you outlined, essentially it's Tom DeLonge writing to John Podesta. Now, some crucial context here for folks is that at the time the email was sent and presumably received by John Podesta, we were in the middle of a highly contentious U.S. election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Podesta was managing Clinton's campaign at that time. And some might say that in itself is noteworthy. They might even ask, and why in the world would Tom DeLonge have been emailing John Podesta? But again, those who follow this topic may also know that Podesta has held a long interest in this topic, going all the way back to his time with the presidency and the administration of Bill Clinton. Podesta had reportedly been very interested in unidentified flying objects. He had made inquiries about what was happening at Area 51 and similar sites. I would say, safe it to say, he might have been a listener of late-night radio programs and certainly would have heard you on some of those, Whitley. And yes. So Podesta kept up with all this. He did, and had done so for a long time. Now, how he specifically came into first communication with Tom DeLonge, we won't know. But what we do know is that they were in communication in 2016, and Tom was speaking. This is my interpretation, Whitley, but I would say that there is a certain degree of familiarity that seems to be conveyed in the email when you read this. He's not saying, "Hi, my name is Tom, and I'd like to talk to you." He is speaking as though, you know, in the tradition of the ancient Greek epics, in medias res, he's in the middle of an ongoing dialogue, and he is conveying at that point to Podesta, listen, Major General McCaslin has been termed a skeptic. He's not. This is a man who's deeply interested in this topic. This is a very important man, Tom says, and that much is evident just from the information we've already reviewed during this discussion. He also, and this is very important, I think, maybe one of the most important aspects to my, in my opinion, McCaslin says, or I'm sorry, Tom DeLonge says that McCaslin was responsible for helping to assemble the people who were now advising Tom DeLonge. So here again, although it might be said that McCaslin had a limited, brief kind of exchange with Tom DeLonge and was offering feedback on this nonfiction book that he was writing, or actually it was a fiction book before that. Again, if he was helping Tom to get to know other officials, as Tom claimed to Podesta in that email, you might say that really McCaslin was especially important in the, you know, helping to assemble what became, again, To the Stars, and which in 2017 really relaunched this modern kind of renaissance of UFO interest. Now, that would be my interpretation, but again, that also seems to bespeak McCaslin's interest in this topic, which, again, is not conveyed explicitly in that email to Podesta.
Well, what is conveyed explicitly is, as you report in the debrief, DeLonge said, "I've been working with him for 4 months," and DeLonge had given him a four-hour presentation. Now, why it would be that DeLonge gave McCaslin the presentation, I don't know, because I can't imagine that he would have had, he must have been very deeply into this, but it does suggest that McCaslin was not as knowledgeable as people would like to believe. Otherwise, why brief him for 4 hours about this subject? But he apparently had ways into it that were very special and also helped DeLonge assemble people like Hal and Jim Semivan and the others to create To the Stars, but did not himself get into it. So, and now let's talk about what he may or may not have known. His wife has specifically said he didn't know anything about the materials or the bodies at Wright Field, Wright Pat. And it was such an odd thing for her to point out in her email, in what has been released, because why even bother to say that? You're trying to communicate to someone that he doesn't know anything dangerous, anything, because I can assure you, information about the bodies is very sensitive. I'm knew two people who had direct knowledge of the bodies. And I was at a wedding with the only other person I know of who also knew, also was that close to this some years ago. And we talked about this very briefly at the wedding. And on the way back, and this will seem fantastic, I had 45 minutes of missing time in LAX. Someone with the capability, I don't know, you probably don't know how missing time works. It is a frequency can turn off the part of the brain called the hippocampus that transmits memories. And the result of this is the memories will be still collected in the amygdala, but you won't be able to access them without specialized intervention, specifically hypnosis done by somebody who understands this, not by a casual individual. And so that happened. That means that, and this was so such a small, insignificant thing, but how important that information is. How very important. And is she saying, is she trying to defend him or reassure someone she knows might want to capture him? What is going on there? Can you speculate even? I don't know.
I'd be happy to speculate. And again, I think that's the term here just because I certainly have thoughts. But two things that she appeared to be conveying and then an interpretive one. It obviously seems that Mrs. McCaslin Wilkerson, her name, she seems to want to try and, I presume, dispel what she interprets as being, you know, rumors, myths, hearsay, or, you know, conspiracy theories, speculation associated with her husband. And that seemingly in response to things that have appeared online. Now, I think you and I would probably agree that maybe some of the speculation that we've seen actually does fall into that kind of category. And yet, as you note the specificity, Whitley, of what she says, she doesn't just say, and frankly, again, I can only imagine what kind of, you know, I mean, heartbreak and concern she is undergoing. Let's not forget her husband is missing. So my heart goes out to her and the entire family. If I were in that same position, God forbid, and a loved one were missing,
I've thought a lot about this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've thought a lot about this because this all happens just on the heels of the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, also a unresolved disappearance. So I've really thought about this. And if I had to make a statement, it would be very difficult. But one thing that I would find it hard to do would to be speak at length about what that missing loved one's interests were. And by virtue of doing so in the message that she posted online, specifically saying, you know, he didn't know where the bodies were. He didn't know the UFO secrets. And then further going on to, speculate a bit about, or rather she appears to be making a joke, I think we might say, about at this point, maybe the best interpretation is that he was abducted, but that there haven't been any UFO sightings over the Sandia Mountains. You know, I cannot begin to assume what a person is thinking when they're going through what she must be going through, but it was oddly specific, some of the things that she was saying. And I don't, interpret that to mean that she actually thinks that Neil was abducted, but I do think that what that must mean, and I'd love to get your opinion on this too, Whitley, it does seem to speak not only to her knowledge of these subjects and the area of topical interest, but seems to also bespeak discussions she and her husband must have had. They seem to be conveying
yes.
an interest in this topic, at least, at very least. But I'd be interested in your thoughts as well.
Well, first, I can tell you from experience, if you get abducted, you're not going to be taking a gun with you. And he did. He took a gun. So as far as I'm concerned, that's impossible. And, you know, I've been with these people, these little gray people, most of my life, and they're Sharpies. They're not going to let anyone come near him with a gun. Absolutely not. So that didn't happen. But they are also very clever. So if they did abduct him, they might have taken the gun in order to make it seem as if he hadn't been abducted. They think like that. In any case, so it's not totally impossible, but it seems highly unlikely, especially because it happened in the middle of the day. Now, I do know of a case in Australia where it happened to a woman in the middle of the day, and they walked in on her unexpectedly while she was house cleaning in broad daylight, and she was gone for 4 hours. So they are quite capable of arriving in a neighborhood and taking somebody and leaving with them and nobody seeing that happen. Just quite recently, but it was admittedly, it was in the early hours of the morning, they took someone who's working with me on a movie, which they do often. You know, I should charge admission if you work with me, because then you got a good chance of getting scoped out by them. In any case, they took her right through the ceiling of her apartment in the middle of the night. So they're capable of this. I don't think so, though. It doesn't strike me as that. It could be, but why would they? But there is someone who might be quite concerned. There's been a lot of pressure from Congress about disclosure. There's been some pressure on the Trump administration, but I have to tell you, I think it's going to probably follow all of the other administrations and not do this. You mentioned John Podesta earlier. The last thing he said after leaving the Obama administration was he was so regretful that they had not released the UFO files.
Yes.
That was in February right after the Obama administration had ended. So that's been something that not one administration has been willing to do in all the history of the United States. What are they hiding? If a general who, let's say, had seen the bodies that are either at Fort Detrick or at Wright, I don't know which anymore for sure, or maybe their bodies at both, I don't know, and had definite knowledge of the materials, because there is certainly at least one in intact UFO. It was at Elgin Air Force Base in Florida for years. I don't know where it is now. There could be more than one. I don't know. And that general came out and sat down in a congressional hearing as a whistleblower. That would end the cover-up. It's too much. A general with direct knowledge is too much. Now, let's get into the subject of the legacy program and its history of trying to control people who want to come out.
Yeah. We have, I guess, really since 2023 heard quite a lot about this. But again, people have followed this for a very long time. I will simply say I have never been made privy to any kind of classified information that I'm not supposed to know about. But like yourself, Whitley, I've spoken to a number of former officials, some of whom, and I suspect in the months and maybe even years going forward, are continuing to or will continue to come forward and talk about things that they know and experienced. But some officials I have spoken to have certainly, even those who somewhat downplay some of the popular claims related to UAP, they have still said, we always got the impression that there was something deeper within the United States defense establishment that we couldn't touch, that we couldn't get access to. And again, that seems to be that so-called legacy program. And many people wonder, how could such a program exist? How could such a program be kept from the public? How could such a program have evaded several U.S. presidential administrations? And in fact, you know, even before you had reached out to me about us having this conversation, I had begun doing some digging into this, and I'd come across a fascinating article from many years ago, which I took some notes on, and I'd like to take a moment to quote from this. This article had been written in 2000 by Bill Sweetman. You may remember Bill. In fact, he had been an aviation journalist for many years, and the article that he had written, published in Jane's International Defense Review, specifically talked about the United States military's black budget and both unacknowledged and then regular special access programs. As he notes about this, And this is important. I want to quote. In 1997, according to the report of a Senate commission, there were around 150 Department of Defense approved special access programs. Sweetman tells us these included special access programs initiated by the department and its branches and those initiated by other agencies, like, for instance, the CIA or the Department of Energy, but which the DOD also had involvement in. He goes on to explain to us that these were divided into very basic types like acquisition, operations, intelligence, and otherwise. But as he goes on to note, specifically, a lot of these acknowledged special access programs had to do with, guess what? You know, stealth aircraft that were being developed by the United States Air Force. He goes on to also say an unacknowledged special access program, or a black program, as we would traditionally call these, is a program which is considered so sensitive that the fact of its existence is a, and he terms this, quote, a core secret. That defined in U.S. Air Force regulations as, in quoting from those regulations, any item, progress, strategy, or element of information, the compromise of which would result in unrecoverable failure. And then he goes on throughout the article to mention not only have there been instances where, again, high-ranking military officials, elected leaders, and others have not been briefed on some of these special access programs, but further, and this I found particularly intriguing, that sometimes technologies, which we might speculate, by the way, either are developed or may be acquired, some technologies are so complex that if the warfighter, if commanders aren't capable of harnessing and utilizing that technology to its fullest, it is deemed in the best interest of U.S. national security not even to allow the information about the existence of said technologies to those military commanders. Now, what Sweetman was, and again, this was way back in 2000, so I mean, you know, a quarter of a decade or more has passed at this point since he wrote this. We're talking about programs in the black world that are so secretive that the technologies may be so complex at times that commanders aren't even informed about their existence. He cites an example where a individual who had led such programs had been completely out of the loop about the existence of special access programs involving his specific area of interest. Now, bringing this back around to Neil McCaslin, as we noted earlier, again, he for a time actually oversaw the program that managed special access programs in the United States. Now, to me, that doesn't mean that he knew about secretly everything that was happening in all those programs. And supposedly, again, there is a small group of, congressional leaders who are supposed to be informed about all the special access programs. But Sweetman argues that there are some instances where some of those may be unacknowledged, not only, or rather, they aren't reported to Congress and certainly not to the president. So the question of, you know, is there a legacy program? Could it exist? And what does that entail? First of all, absolutely it could exist. And fundamentally, the question I would ask is, are we talking about a technology, one acquired in this case, so far beyond anything known to us here on planet Earth that indeed that would be the kind of thing, the core secret, right, that would be kept from presidential administrations throughout the ages? That is not an implausible scenario by any stretch of the imagination. If such acquisitions were ever made, that is the kind of legacy program we're talking about. Now, the question of whether Neil McCaslin would have had any knowledge of that, we could only speculate.
He took a pistol with him. I think this is a very important fact. It means to me a number of things, possibly. Maybe he decided to commit suicide and went out and did it in a place where he would not soon be found, which would be an exceptionally cruel thing to do. And from what I know of his family at this point and him, that's not a choice he would have made. As simple as that. Now, but you never know what the secrets are inside a person's head. Now, if he thought that somebody was going to capture him, to take him, and render him into a classified prison facility, and there are a number of them, and make him just disappear, he might have gone into hiding, which would certainly be a motive for taking a pistol with him. Let me ask you another question, and this is a little bit off the subject, and if you can't recall immediately, we'll understand perfectly. Do you know any offhand, any stories of other people in particular in space sciences or laser-related physics who have disappeared or died mysteriously, say, in the past couple of years?
Not within the past couple of years. There was another missing person. Let me see if I can find this information just because we're kind of going off the cuff. And again, for the listeners at home, Whitley and I did not, you know, plan out questions particularly. We're having a great conversation just off the cuff here. So I'm glad you asked that question. There was an individual who was reported just the other day, Monica Reza, I believe was her name. Have you been tracking this, Whitley?
No, I haven't. I have been tracking it a little bit, yeah.
Yes.
Her family did not think that any kind of foul play was involved. Is that the same case?
I believe so. And again, just reporting here based on what was released by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. So again, this was a good distance away from where Neil McCaslin vanished. But she was reported, and according to the information here, this was actually summer of last year. The important point, though, apparently being that Monica Reza had also worked under that same division that Neil McCaslin had overseen. Now, I don't know if that was in the same time frame. And again, it seems that temporally and also chronologically, her disappearance seems far enough removed that I would be very hesitant to try and draw any kind of correlations between these two. But again, just to answer your question, that's the only other one in the immediate recent past that I recall. As far as people claiming their own lives or any other kinds of strange circumstances involving this, though, with regard to defense officials, you know, we could certainly say that in the broader history that that's the case. And if we go back to James Forrestal, that's probably one of the most historically relevant ones in terms of speculations related to UAP and the idea of the beginnings of a so-called legacy program.
Yeah, so I've thought to myself that, you know, we both know a lot of people who are very knowledgeable about this stuff. I mentioned Hal and Jim Semivan. They're both dear friends, and I mean, really good friends. Hal and I have been close friends and I do consider him a close friend, him and his wife very much so, for years and years, 30 years. Do you think that if this was done to, if Neil is on the run because he's afraid of being rendered into a classified prison or something, that the others should be concerned? Or what about Lou Elizondo or Jake Barber or David Grush? I know Lou, and I know I don't know David very well, but I certainly know Lou, and I know Jake, and they're lovely men. They're really good men, and these are all good people. And you know, I'm not interested in the conspiracy theories about them because I know them, and I just think, are they in jeopardy? Could they be?
That's a good question. Again, speculating here, though, let me actually first point this out. Whitley, as we have heard in congressional testimony that's been provided in recent years, really since going back, I guess, to the establishment of the UAP Task Force, and then, of course, its successor organization, the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. In these congressional testimonies from whistleblowers who have come forward, many have spoken about reprisals that they experienced. David Grush termed it like this. He said, it was made known to me that there were people who could touch me at any time. And he said that essentially that there were many instances where people tried to discredit him and that there were things that were done or that he experienced that indicated that this was the case. Lou Elizondo said the same sort of thing. There are other officials whom I have communicated with who, some of them are publicly known, but I won't name them here for, sake of their privacy and respect for their, private communications with me. But certainly they also have spoken of the kinds of reprisals. And I can't imagine the reason for that other than the simple fact that this is a sensitive enough topic to the U.S. intelligence community that there are measures taken to prevent people or to try and discourage people from coming out and speaking publicly about this. Those reasons seem to be pretty obvious. So like yourself, without engaging in conspiracy theories or anything along those lines, I could think of logical reasons why there would be attempts to try and protect this secret, unfortunately, by threatening individuals who claim to have knowledge about it. Now, I cannot tell you if Major General William Neil McCaslin was one of those people. And to come back to an earlier point that you made, and you emphasized this, I agree with you 100%. This is a crucial, maybe vital point about this. The most recent update, as of yesterday, as of the time you and I are speaking, released by the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office, stated that the items missing from his home included that light-colored hiking-type shirt, hiking boots were missing, and they said that what appeared to be a revolver and a leather holster for that revolver had been taken as well. The wallet of the missing man was also taken, but his prescription glasses were not. His phone, personal phone, was not taken. And also wearable devices. I'm old-fashioned, Whitley. I still wear a classic watch, and it takes a battery. But, I'm presuming wearable devices would be something like an Apple smartwatch, right? It's an odd thing for a person to leave their home and presuming that he chose to take a weapon with him, to carry that instead of methods that could be used to communicate. Now, this is speculation, but what else can those devices be used for? We can use them to communicate, but again, a smartphone is a portable multifunction device. It performs any number of capabilities, but it can also be used to track an individual. So one could infer that again, Neil McCaslin, at the time he disappeared, either had no intention of communicating with people, or potentially that he was attempting to prevent someone from being able either to communicate with him or, more importantly, to track him and determine his whereabouts. We can only speculate, and we need to be very careful at this stage in the investigation about doing that. But again, I think that those are some potentially crucial clues that the sheriff's office there in Bernalillo County have released. And something tells me that those will prove vital in determining eventually whatever has happened to the missing official.
I promised you that we would end this at the bottom of the hour, and it's the bottom of the hour. So I believe you have another appointment, but if you can spend another 5 minutes with us, that would be great.
I could do five more, sure.
Okay, yeah. Great. We are talking to Micah Hanks, The Debrief, MicahHanks.com. Obviously, if you're really interested in this subject, you should get The Debrief. It is published weekly, and I don't believe it costs a thing, does it?
That's correct. Yes, everything that we publish is freely available to the public.
Right. So, an extraordinary effort being made by a quiet but very, very skilled reporter, Micah Hanks. Also, I might mention that Transformation 2026 is available on Amazon in an audiobook read by me and softcover and a Kindle and soon a hardcover as well. So there's a lot going on, and don't forget to support unknowncountry.com as a subscriber. Now, we have a situation here where, let me read something from, we've talked about this before, something his wife said. Neil does not have any special knowledge about the ET bodies and debris from the Roswell crash stored at Wright Pat. And then, as you pointed out earlier, she says, with absolutely no sign of him, maybe the best hypothesis is that the aliens beamed him up to the mothership. It's so lighthearted. In other words, this doesn't sound like a person in the grip of the misery of losing a loved one. It sounds like somebody who might know where he is. I wonder. Might know that he absconded because he was under some kind of stress.
Yeah. Again, it's so difficult to know. And again, why I wanted to emphasize the uncertainty that surrounds, how a person, any individual from one to the next, might react to circumstances like this. So again, my heart goes out to Mrs. McCaslin Wilkerson. I will also say that the specificity of the terminology used in her statement was not missed by me. Obviously, it was not missed by you, Whitley, and many others. I'm certainly aware of have brought that to my attention, have paid attention to it as well. But You know, it's rare, and I can't think of another situation. And again, really just to kind of underscore the importance of all this, I cannot think of another specific circumstance in recent memory, and maybe really in most of the history of this topic, where an individual who would have held such a high rank and who would have worked specifically in the, you know, the scientific division. I mean, again, overseeing some 11,000, I believe, by some counts, maybe more than that, scientists and engineers within the United States Air Force and their technological and scientific research in support of that branch of the U.S. military. I can't think of another instance where someone who held that kind of pedigree in terms of the history of, you know, military, modern warfare, aviation technology, but also its relationship to the UAP issue has just vanished off the face of the planet. And again, we look at, again, the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie. An absolute tragedy. But we had Ring camera footage that was accessible after a few days. Some would argue maybe it took far too long for authorities to be able to access that. I'm not in a position to judge. I will simply say, though, that they were able to obtain Ring camera footage that gave us at least a look at some sort of what appears to be a suspect, obviously. In the case of Neil McCaslin, you would think that we would have a blueprint for what to do and what not to do in a missing person case, and one to have occurred so quickly after the Nancy Guthrie story, which captivated the minds of Americans and people throughout the world. And yet, I know, as you do, law enforcement officials have been asking for surveillance footage, for, you know, home cameras, you know, smartphone cameras, drone cameras, GoPros that people, hikers, might have been, you know, using when they're in the Sandia Mountains while hiking. It's known that he was an avid hiker and outdoorsman. No evidence, nothing, apart from that U.S. Air Force sweater, which they're not really certain if that sweatshirt was even related to him. No data has been provided from the public or otherwise that seems to indicate where he went. He literally just vanished from the face of the earth. I couldn't imagine a more mysterious circumstance involving an individual with the kind of background that Major General McCaslin held.
And there we have to leave it, folks. This is it. This is what we know. Of course, we will keep you updated on Dreamland, as always. Next week on Dreamland, we're going to be talking to the Dream Detective, the man who dreamed the Lockerbie bombing right before it happened and told the police about it and almost ended up being thrown in jail himself because his dream was so accurate. A very weird guy. Then later, we're going to be talking to my dear friend Jeff Kripal. Jeff is, of course, the co-author of Supernatural with me. He has arranged the Archives of the Impossible, where the Communion Letters are stored. And then down the road, we're going to be talking with Lucinda, a close encounter witness unlike any you have ever heard. So there's a lot ahead on Dreamland. Thank you so much for being with us, Micah Hanks, MicahHanks.com.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.